Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. There are two things, it seems to me, that unite Americans: the post office and the weather report. By unite, I mean that people universally disparage them. Oh, the post office. There's always a long line and only one clerk. They're all on break or hanging out in the back. Oh, those weather forecasters. They don't know anything. They're always wrong. I confess I find this amusing. I actually use the post office a lot. Yes, even in this day of digital communication. And my experience is quite good. I like chatting with the clerks, choosing the prettiest stamps, feeling that sense of satisfaction as my letter or package gets plopped into the mail slot. As for the weather forecasts, it's nonsense to suggest that they're usually wrong. If that were the case, then why would people pay attention to them at all? Why would they take an umbrella along on a day when rain is predicted? Why dress for 90 degrees if you're so sure the weatherman doesn't know what he's talking about? I think these are just subjects people like to gripe about. It's a bonding experience, sort of like when primates groom each other. But if you look at meteorology, you not only see a lot of fascinating data, but also a lot of drama. The history of this science is full of it, and it's all relatively recent. I mean, in the past 50 years. Today's Soundprint is about all that data and that drama, going back to 1957, the International Geophysical Year, or IGY. It brought breakthroughs in our understanding of weather and how to predict it. The program, produced by Barbara Bogave, is called Weather Report.
What we're looking at right now is a system that's developing over here north of Cape Colbert and is going to be sliding to the east, over just to the east of McMurdo, over the next 24 hours. And the forecast right now is for this low to
And that's just
to
a routine weather forecast from Antarctica. The weather report. It is so routine. It's so available that it's easy to forget that not so long ago, forecasting the weather wasn't at all routine. And it certainly wasn't sophisticated.
There's just one man who has the say. Who else but the weatherman?
And here's the latest weather report. Overcast and warmer.
Is the weather overcast? Is it nice outside? Do you plan to take a walk or will you have to ride? There's just one man to be your guide. Who else but the weatherman?
And here's the latest weather report. Sunny, chance of showers.
When you wake up in the morning...
And that's about as technical as weather reports got. Until a brilliant meteorologist came along who was decades ahead of his time. He was able to imagine what orbiting satellites could do for forecasting when these man-made moons were still the stuff of science fiction.
There will be a clear area over the western mountains, and then as the satellite comes farther east over Texas... To the north, there will emerge a very solid cloud deck caused by air from the mountains pushing over this dome of Canadian Arctic air coming down from the north.
Today, our story involves a man with a vision who played a key role in a global scientific undertaking known as the IGY and who helped launch a new era of weather forecasting. Our story begins with the Second World War. Once the United States entered World War II, one thing became clear. To fight a global air war, you need a lot of weathermen. Christine Harper teaches history at Florida State University.
Roosevelt announces that we're going to build 50,000 airplanes. Well, you cannot have people flying 50,000 airplanes without forecasts for the weather for those airplanes. And there were only 400 meteorologists in the United States before World War II started. 400 people are not going to be able to forecast for 50,000 airplanes. So a crash program was put together that pulled in almost all men who had backgrounds in physics and mathematics and turned them into meteorologists in less than a year.
Ed Flowers landed in meteorology entirely by chance.
I went in the Navy to actually avoid the draft. After boot camp, we were given assignments, and mine happened to be as a weather person.
The young meteorologists were nicknamed Met Men. They honed their forecasting skills during the war, and when the fighting ended, they returned to a much more high-tech world than the one they had left. Chris Harper.
As an outgrowth of the war, we now have a whole bunch of strong physics and math background people in meteorology, which we didn't have before. We have loads of new observational data, both upper air and at the surface, because the war was global. It was in the tropics. It was in high latitudes where we'd never had data before. And at the end of the war, we have the development of the digital computer that was going to be able to handle all the data.
Add to that list high-powered rockets, which scientists could use to explore the upper atmosphere. And taken all together, you have the makings of a scientific revolution. A revolution known as the International Geophysical Year, or IGY for short. IGY weather observer Bruce Leeske.
The International Geophysical Year, a cooperative venture of many countries and many scientific disciplines to investigate the physics of the atmosphere, this habitat where we live.
Meteorologist Harry Wexler was chosen as scientific leader of the Antarctic program. He had a vision of what the IGY could lead to.
Meteorologists must know what is happening throughout the entire atmosphere, laterally, from pole to pole, and vertically, at least 20 miles high. They must know what streams of energy the sun is pouring into our atmosphere, and the return energy to space. Even the oceans, with their almost infinite reservoir of heat, moisture, and salts, must be taken into account.
Jim Fleming teaches the history of science and technology at Colby College.
What was unknown at the time of the IGY about global weather patterns were global weather patterns. That is, we didn't have Earth-orbiting satellites. We didn't have a sense of how the southern hemisphere worked in coordination with the northern hemisphere.
We didn't know much, but Harry Wexler knew more than practically anyone else.
I mean, I'm just wild about Harry.
I'm just wild about Harry.
Well, Harry Wexler was the leading meteorologist in the nation in 1940 to 1960. He developed the kinds of technologies that people take for granted today. For example, numerical weather prediction using computers, use of radar meteorology. He was the first person to fly in a hurricane as an observer.
Wait a second. He was the first scientist to intentionally fly into a hurricane? Where do you even come up with an idea like that? Well, it turns out that the Second World War played a role there, too. Jim Fleming.
The typhoons in the Pacific were a big issue during World War II because the fleet had to avoid them. And so pilots would go out hurricane hunting. They would fly off the carriers and off the islands and look for storms because we had no satellite coverage. And so there was a tradition of looking for storms and trying to map where they might be. But Harry Wexler was the first PhD-trained meteorologist, the first real observer to go out on a hurricane hunt. Well, what did Harry say about flying into the hurricane? He said, it was sure bumpy. It was sure a wild ride. But the actual report is the clouds were at 37,000 feet and the moisture was, 89%. And he really gave a scientific account as well as a kind of the bumpy ride, the joy of the primal, I guess you would call it, experience of being closely, vulnerably next to such an awesome phenomenon.
Harry the Hurricane Hunter went on to become chief of research at the U.S. Weather Bureau. Chris Harper.
And he says, if we can get an artificial satellite up there, then we ought to be able to figure out how we can send down pictures. And we'll be able to see hurricanes before they cream Florida.
Harry Wexler had a big vision for meteorology.
Historian Jim Fleming.
My colleagues and I actually call it making science global. And Wexler did have a vision of how the integrated Earth, ocean, and even space sciences could work together to get a better picture of the planet.
A much bigger vision. Wexler was looking at everything from how weather patterns in the tropics relate to patterns at the poles, to how heat is transported through the atmosphere, and even all the way back in 1957, he was worried about the greenhouse effect. In fact, Wexler made studying carbon dioxide levels part of the IGY program.
The carbon dioxide of the Antarctic atmosphere will be measured to see if the greenhouse effect of the atmosphere is increasing. There's so much carbon dioxide being released by the combustion of coal and oil that if continued at the present rate for the rest of the century, it will nearly double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, bringing, so to speak, a thicker pane of glass in the atmospheric greenhouse, increasing the warmth within.
Wechsler certainly had a grand theory, but as scientific leader of the entire IGY program, he faced huge practical challenges. If you're interested in global weather patterns, you need exact measurements from points all over the world, taken at exactly the same time, so that you can create a weather chart which serves as a frame of reference to track, say, a developing typhoon or a period of high pressure moving across the Atlantic.
The desire of the people planning the Antarctic program and the IGY was to get a lot of stations, so we would have what they call synoptic observations, in other words, all at the same time. So we had a lot of different countries taking weather observations at the same time and then transmitting that data to places like Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, which would be very helpful for them in doing weather forecasts.
During the IGY, the science of weather mapping was raised to an art. Planners conceived of an IGY calendar, which named 3 days in each month World Days. On these days, scientists all over the world recorded intensively detailed observations, synchronized to the exact second, to create a complete global picture of physical forces affecting the Earth at that time. As part of the American effort, Wechsler set up something called Weather Central, Antarctica's weather station to the world.
My name is Paul Dalrymple, and I lived in Massachusetts at the time, and I went to the Antarctic during the International Geophysical Year as a micrometeorologist at Little America 5 on the Ross Ice Shelf.
For the past 50 years, Paul Dalrymple has hosted an annual summer picnic for IGY alumni at his home in Port Clyde, Maine. If you go, you're likely to see trucks in his driveway with vanity license plates like S-Pole and Iceberg. His house overflows with penguin memorabilia. He has stuffed penguins, painted penguins, photographs, sculpted cardboard penguins, and a seemingly inexhaustible supply of chocolate penguins.
I just love to have Antarctic people come there. And when someone comes here from a foreign country, they bring them down to my house because they say my house is almost like a museum.
Like many scientists of his generation, Dalrymple was inspired by Admiral Richard E. Byrd. He even wrote a letter to Byrd when he was a kid.
Dear Admiral Richard E. Byrd, I have read all of your books and once heard a lecture by your fellow explorer, Bud Waite. When I grow up, I want to be a polar explorer just like you.
I had a letter from Admiral Byrd when the International Geophysical Year came along. I had written him before telling him that I would like to go to the Antarctic. He told me at the time he would put my letter on file. I never thought that he would do that, but when the IGY came, Admiral Byrd wrote me, said, "Are you still interested in going to the Antarctic?"
Dalrymple saw Weather Central built from the ground up.
Weather Central was the first time in the history of the Antarctic where they established what would amount to a weather station. There were stations all the way around Antarctica. There were some 50-odd stations. And the information from their observations all came into Little America.
I was at Little America at the same time Paul Dalrymple was there. Paul was one of my roommates.
Bruce Leeske wintered over in Antarctica as a member of the IGY Weather Central in 1956.
Paul was known as Scroungy Redbeard, and he also was famous for the fact that he set up what was called a rumor central. Paul liked to have fun, and sometimes it was false information to get everybody excited and kind of alleviate the boredom. A lot of funny things happened there. Yeah, so they painted pictures. I remember somebody did a picture of a country scene, you know, and they framed that beautifully and put it over the urinal.
Weather Central was run 24 hours a day. Well, it all came over the teletype system into the cam, and they bring the data in. The people would plot the data, and they would draw the analysis, what they call synoptic meteorology.
Leeske was a plotter for Weather Central. He plugged in the data.
Clusters of numbers from the different stations, like the French station at Durville, or the Australian station at Mawson, or the Japanese station at Showa, or the Pole station. And then the clusters of numbers were then decoded and entered on a weather map.
We had a Russian meteorologist. We had Argentine meteorologist. We had a forecaster from Alaska. We had a couple of graduate students from universities that were in meteorology. And the man that was in head of Weather Central was hand-selected by Harry Wexler. A team of six meteorologists, all professionals.
And then the analyst would then draw the map from that, in other words, connecting lines of constant pressure, which are called isobars, or lines of constant temperature, isotherms. And then by connecting all these data together, you could draw a weather map and draw the fronts, the warm fronts, the cold fronts, the occluded fronts.
And then they would distribute the forecast to all the other stations.
Isn't it wild to think about all this happening with adding machines and slide rules? I mean, pretty much all we know about weather these days comes from digital number crunching. But this was a whole other world. These guys were hand-drawing maps and charts in a bunker, sometimes under 15 feet of snow. Chief Scientist Harry Wexler wasn't one of the number crunchers. He was based in Washington during the IGY, but he did travel a few times by icebreaker to Antarctica to check on the program. He kept a diary on his trips.
It's rather frightening now when one is here to think of the small group of people still 800 miles further on to the south, surrounded entirely by snow and sky and cut off from the normal contacts that the stations on the coast will have. Coming in, I realized the immensity of their solitude and isolation.
Weather Central served two purposes. It coordinated and tracked simultaneous weather observations among the far-flung IGY meteorology stations, and that provided a base level of data from Antarctica. It also produced weather reports that kept scientists and pilots from wandering out into blizzards or flying into mountains. Thomas Gray served at Weather Central in 1957.
When you can't see a horizon, then you are getting into what is a whiteout. You do not know where the solid snow is, and you can fall, stumble. Airplanes have been known to run into the ground. So this was one of the things that we had to watch for.
All this weather mapping required launching lots of weather balloons. That's a tricky business in polar conditions. More than tricky, actually. It's dangerous. Bruce Leeske.
We had to make our own hydrogen, and I don't remember the exact chemical process, but we used aluminum chips and some kind of acid or something. We generated our own hydrogen, which, of course, is an explosive-type gas. And the guys would get all set up with their large antenna, which would track the instrument.
As the balloon went up, it recorded the temperature, the air pressure, the humidity, and height. But first, you had to get the thing in the air.
And then my job, I mean, I really wasn't an observer, but I had to do this for them. I would stand up in the cold on the top of the inflation shelter, is what it was called, holding the instrument. And then they would open up the doors, the big trap doors, and then they would say,
"Are you ready?"
Yeah, it's like,
"Okay, let it go."
And the string was about 10, 15 feet long, and it would fly out of there. And if it was windy, you had to gauge it properly. If you dropped that instrument before the balloon was at a certain height, it fell to the ground and shattered. And if you didn't let go of it at the right time, it would jerk it out of your hands and break the calibration, break the instruments. And then they had to start all over again, generating this hydrogen.
Right. Imagine this in 60 below zero and frozen socks. But the scientists toughed it out, and they managed to paint the first real picture of the Antarctic climate. Harry Wexler laid out what they learned for Congress in a hearing in 1959.
Everyone speaks of the Antarctic as cold, snowy, and miserable. It isn't. It has a great range of climate. As a matter of fact, I was quite interested in seeing that the difference in temperature that occurs in wintertime between our Banana Belt station, the Wilkes station, and at the pole is larger than the difference in temperature between Miami Beach, Florida, and the Canadian Arctic.
As the raw data was pouring in, some IGY scientists were almost blindly feeling their way towards what would become a theory about climate change in the Antarctic. Morton Rubin worked with Harry Wexler at the U.S. Weather Bureau before the IGY and was tapped by him to be his man on the ground in Antarctica. While he was there, Mort realized they were onto something.
I was analyzing all the upper air data that was coming in and doing upper air analysis, and I decided that there was a need to develop some idea of what the heat and mass balance of the Antarctic is.
Rubin was studying atmospheric exchange and how ice melting and the loss of heat from Antarctica can affect other weather systems in other parts of the world. Now, today, it's commonplace to worry about whether melting glaciers are going to raise ocean levels. But back then, this was new, cutting-edge science. And people like Mort Rubin were gathering measurements to provide a baseline by which scientists could calculate global climate change in the future.
So I would get some glaciological data and to see what the outflow was in terms of ice from the continent.
Outflow, meaning how Antarctica's melting, reflecting, and heat-absorbing ice affects the world's ocean levels and currents.
And I would be able to determine from the basis of these upper air soundings how much heat and moisture was being transported across the Antarctic boundary.
Because when ice melts, it releases heat and moisture into the air, which can affect atmospheric weather patterns elsewhere.
So that was a very crude and first effort.
Heat and mass balance are vital questions now for global climate researchers working in Antarctica. But the scientific community in the 1950s had a different focus. Historian Jim Fleming.
The period of the IGY was interesting because ideas about weather control were very widespread. At General Electric Corporation, Irving Langmuir was claiming that he could control the weather using chemicals like dry ice or silver iodide. It could make rain on demand. Others were talking about the use of nuclear weapons to either disrupt storms or redirect hurricanes.
In weather control, meteorology has a new goal worthy of its greatest efforts.
Harry was on top of this literature and gave a lecture about that time on what he called the possibilities of climate control.
This could be done by creating an artificial cloud. Such a cloud would increase surface temps in winter by as much as 10 to 30 degrees.
Harry Wexler lectured on how to increase the Earth's temperature by a degree or two, how to cool it off by a degree or two, how to cut a big hole in the ozone layer and change everything, and how to manipulate the Earth's atmosphere using the kinds of insights he was getting from his Earth orbiting satellites and from the general circulation models, which were just beginning to be put into the computers at the time.
But unlike many of the scientists of his day, Wexler tempered his optimism with caution.
Climate control can best be classified as an interesting hypothetical exercise until the consequences of tampering with large-scale atmospheric events can be assessed in advance. Man, in applying his growing energies and facilities against the power of the winds and storms, may do so with more enthusiasm than knowledge, and so cause more harm than good.
In fact, Wexler was worried about a hole in the ozone layer as early as 1957, and he made ozone studies a part of the IGY program. Thomas Gray.
Well, we were in Antarctica. We did special soundings in which we sent evacuated bottles and opened them at certain places and so on. And so they managed to get some information about the ozone over Antarctica.
Bruce Leeske.
I remember some work on ozone. I think Ben Harlan, who was in charge of all the weather, U.S. weather observers in Antarctica, and he was also a part of our group. But I believe Ben Harlan had some evacuated glass flask, which from time to time they would open up and take an air sample. But there was very little discussion that I recall of ozone at the time. Of course, it did become a big issue later on.
At the same time, Wexler was culling research on pollution, smog, space travel, and space junk, and pulling together a prescient theory of global warming.
And also, Wexler became very interested in how vulnerable the Earth's ozone layer might be. because of increased rocket traffic and exhaust fumes up there. He thought that certain chemicals might deplete the ozone layer.
For decades, we've been releasing huge quantities of carbon dioxide and other gases and particles to the lower atmosphere. It is recognized that this atmospheric pollution may have serious effect not only on health, but on global radiation or heat balance, which is the cause of our present pattern of climate and weather.
This is about 10 years before the publicly known story about ozone depletion. And so his legacy of the IGY and ozone studies, polar warming studies, and I think as well, I'll mention again on carbon dioxide studies, are lasting legacies that continue to be very hot scientific topics today.
The massive amount of information collected during the IGY went to research facilities called World Data Centers. It was archived, made available, and it's still available to researchers. Sadly, Harry Wexler died young of a heart attack, literally at his desk. So he never saw one of his greatest dreams realized, the World Weather Watch. It exists to this day. And if you fix your high-power telescope on the eastern limb of the moon, you can see Wexler Crater. Remember those old Polaroids from the 50s and 60s? That's one way to think of the IGY.
You could look back on it and consider it a kind of an old family photograph of planet Earth. So historically it's important because it gives us a baseline from which to argue. Because every day now, every second really, the kinds of things that we've put up in space and the sensors we have are collecting an IGY's worth of data every second.
Bring all this moisture up in here, and as a result, we're looking at some winds in the 20s, gusts to 30s tomorrow afternoon. The thing is, this is going to be a situation where we'll probably stop flying tomorrow and Saturday.
Now I'm just wild about Harry.
Weather Report was produced by Barbara Bogave with production assistance from Dion Bélanger and Katie Ball. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot with production assistant and Nkechi Mogekwu. Archival tape courtesy of the Bird Polar Research Center at Ohio State University. Thanks to Whitman College and Paul Dalrymple. Harry Wexler voiceover by Hank Rosenfeld. This program is part of Pole to Pole, an international media collaboration celebrating the International Polar Year, produced with support from the National Science Foundation. Look for more content on our special Pole to Pole site, which has a button on our homepage, soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint episodes are available for a small fee by calling toll-free 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love hearing from you. The best way to get in touch is by email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.